abetted by a lack of media sunlight. Hoping to help shed that light is writer and activist Paul Rosenberg. He's a contributor at Salon.com and a senior editor for Random Lengths News. He'll join us to talk about his recent roundup of what he calls an anti-democratic red tide and what can be done to stop it. Also on the show, the New York Times recently front-paged a story about Victorina Morales, an undocumented immigrant from Guatemala who works as a housekeeper at Donald Trump's National Golf Club in New Jersey. It's a sort of a gotcha piece. Another powerful politician who abuses undocumented immigrants, rhetorically and actually, yet profits off their labor. But Morales' story is also about the nature of her work. The fact that it's so easy to overlook the people, largely women of color, who clean and cook and care for millions of Americans, mostly non-presidents. Morales isn't strictly speaking a domestic worker, but she'd be among the many who would benefit from the uplift intended by the new piece of legislation, the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights, that seeks to provide protections, rights, and dignity to this critical group of caregivers. We'll talk about that with Mariana Vituro, Deputy Director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. You know someone has lived well enough to rattle the establishment, when the New York Times smears them in their obituary. That distinction was achieved by William Bloom, historian and critic of U.S. foreign policy, once a State Department computer programmer who aspired to take part in the great anti-communist crusade. Bloom quit government in 1967 out of disgust with the Vietnam War and became a founding editor of the Washington Free Press, one of the first alternative papers of the New Left. In books like The CIA, A Forgotten History, which was re-released as Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II, and Rogue State, A Guide to the World's Only Superpower, Bloom documented the violent and anti-democratic record of the U.S. empire. We at FAIR frequently had cause to cite his work. So how did the New York Times frame this remarkable life? With this remarkable headline, quote, William Bloom, U.S. policy critic cited by bin Laden, dies at 85, close quote. Yes, to the Times, the most important thing about Bill Bloom's life is that Osama bin Laden once remarked that Rogue State would be useful for Americans to read. Bloom denounced the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks in New York and Washington, his obituary writer Sam Roberts acknowledged, but he didn't disavow bin Laden's recommendation or express sufficient regret that bin Laden also held disdain for the policies carried out by the department for which he had once worked. While Roberts doesn't suggest what sort of formulation would have been deemed satisfactory, a good guess would be none. Along with that headline, the piece achieved what former FAIR staffer Peter Hart called peak New York Times, with the line that Bloom had reiterated, quote, his unpopular but not unique position that American intervention abroad had been breeding enemies and inviting terrorism, close quote. Unpopular, but not unique. That's a good one. If the New York Times would work as hard on the sort of clear-eyed examination of U.S. foreign policy and honest reckoning with its repercussions that Bloom provided, they might have less need for that sort of posthumous pettiness. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. One can make too much of political gestures, but when 44 former senators co-sign an op-ed declaring that the country is entering a dangerous period, there may be something to see here. The piece, signed by 32 Democrats, 10 Republicans, and 2 independents, had reference to investigations of Donald Trump, But the ex-lawmaker's stated concern about the rule of law and the ability of our institutions to function freely and independently could be well applied in numerous places around the country, where, as our next guest reports, we are seeing in the wake of the midterms, quote, a red tide of anti-democratic power grabs, strategies, tactics, and rationales designed to deny the will of the voters, close quote. Paul Rosenberg is a writer and activist. He's senior editor for Random Lengths News, as well as a columnist for Al Jazeera English and a contributor at Salon.com. He joins us now by phone from Southern California. Welcome back to Counterspin, Paul Rosenberg.
Thank you.
Well, there's a lot of skullduggery to talk about. I know in your piece, your recent piece for Salon, you break it into some different categories, but really start anywhere you like on these power grabs that are going on.
Well, I think the most blatant that have gotten the most attention have been in Wisconsin. Right. And secondarily in Michigan, where you just have this wholesale rebellion of the legislatures against the will of the people. And in Wisconsin, you had a Democrat elected governor and attorney general, and you have the legislatures try to take power away from them or succeed so far. Yeah. There may be court battles that will probably drag out. This is what's expected. Similarly, same thing in Michigan, although there you have three women elected to the governor's of the Attorney General and the Secretary of State position, and all three of them are under attack there, plus a whole raft of three citizen initiatives that they're trying to cripple, and then two other initiatives that were taken off the ballot because they were passed by the legislature instead. And that then enabled them to come back and fiddle with them afterwards. And this was something that's never been done before. But in fact, there was an opinion by the Attorney General dating back to 1964, I believe, that said you couldn't do that. But then after the midterm elections, the defeated candidate for governor, who's the sitting Attorney General, wrote a new opinion that said, yes, they can do that. And so you're seeing all this basically based on gerrymandered districts. These permanent majorities that do not have majority support are taking power away from the people and from their elected representatives, the governors, attorney general, and in the case of Michigan, also the secretary of state. So that's sort of the essence of what the most consistent pattern has been, and we see that also in several other places. The Florida people were very aware of the restoration of felon voting rights. Well, after that happened, there's been a similar thing happening in Florida where the chief election officer is saying, well, I need some guidance in terms of how this should be implemented. And the people who passed it said, no, you don't need any guidance at all. It's completely self-executing.
Right.
And so there's talk there about the legislature getting involved with that as well.
I just want to draw you out, and in case that's not clear for folks, we're talking about ballot initiatives. And in Michigan, you say it was pulled off the ballot, and that was in order to make it something that the legislature could then go back in and fiddle with.
Correct.
And fiddle with, we can understand that to mean as much as overturn the intention of the original initiative.
Well, basically, to really subvert it, there were two of them. Yeah. One was for a minimum wage increase, and the other was a paid leave act. And what they did was significantly weaken them.
Mm-hmm.
The figures on the minimum wage law is it was going to go to $12 an hour by 2022 and by 2024 for tipped workers. And they changed it so it would only go to $12 an hour by 2030. That's quite a bit longer. They eliminated the cost of living adjustments as well. And for the tipped workers, it would only go up to $4.58 per hour, with the employers responsible for making up the difference. They fell below that. But that's, you know, it's a very much more muddled situation. And it was by 2030. So we're talking about a much longer period of time. And given inflation, it's not even clear that that's really going to be any increase at all.
And the point is, it's not what people said they wanted.
It was nothing close to what they said. But it's a combination of subverting the will and making it so confused it's even hard to understand what's going on. So it's both confusing and subverting.
Well, in your piece that's up at Salon, you walk through a lot of this information, and a question that comes to the reader's mind and that you respond to is this legal? You know, and it turns out that a number of these moves, they're legal, but people don't do them, you know?
Right. The phrase constitutional hardball was introduced by law professor Mark Tushnet when he was at Georgetown, and well, I guess it was in 2003 or so. He's now at Harvard Law, and he means basically something that is technically legal under the Constitution, but that people just haven't done. And it was conceived of at the federal level, but it's applicable here as well, and it's even more complicated because what may be constitutional under state constitution and the federal constitution may be at variance, and so it can get very tangled up. And in some cases, some of these things may be illegal. They're just so over the line. But the idea basically is to do things you can get away with that will be found legal, but that no one would ever have thought of doing. And, you know, it is legal for an attorney general to overturn a previous opinion of another attorney general. There's no law against doing that. It just isn't done, especially done after the election, so that then they can act in a lame duck session. That violates several norms at once.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But it's not illegal.
Well,
at least not on its face. Now, of course, it could be illegal. It could go up to the state Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court might say, you can't do that.
Right.
It violates a deep fundamental constitutional principle. Thing is, those principles are upheld by norms, and it's only if a court rules that that norm has the force of law that it then becomes illegal. And so that's what hardball is all about. It's about reshaping the norms. It's something that conservatives do a lot more than liberals because they're interested in really changing the way our government works. They're really in a long-term effort to undo the New Deal and all of the state constitutions that have similar kinds of governing philosophies.
At various points in this article, you note undercoverage, and I'm hearing you say how thorny it is, and at the same time, it's not impossible to see through it. It's not impossible to make sense of what's going on. So any undercoverage is lamentable, you know, especially given that darkness is only going to abet these kinds of anti-democratic measures.
Clearly, and they do things very, very quickly precisely because of that, because they don't want people looking and seeing what they're doing. When people did get wind, I mean, we had another wave of incredible protests in Madison, Wisconsin, reminiscent of 2011, precisely because of that, because they were trying to rush something through so quickly. Because they were hiding it as best they could.
And then just before I got on the phone to talk to you, I was looking through coverage and I saw a piece, a fact-checking piece from the Associated Press, and it's, of course, with reference to Evers and Walker in Wisconsin, and the headline was, "Will Evers still have plenty of power?" You know? And I just thought, wow, is that the angle we're going to go for? You know, like, oh, it doesn't matter, he's still going to have plenty of power. What would be useful journalism at this point?
Well, I think the more useful journalism is to talk about it, quite frankly, in terms of growing authoritarianism, because this is what they're trying to do. They're trying to take power away from the people, away from their elected representatives. Another aspect of this, which I didn't get into in this story because this is, you know, about these particular sets of actions, but they did reference it. There are similar kinds of actions in stripping power and restricting state courts.
Right.
But it's precisely because state courts can say, no, you can't do this, and legislators don't want courts telling them what they can do, so they've been stripping power of state courts as well. And that's basically all the kinds of things that, as you said in your introduction, it's the things that people are waking up to with Donald Trump. But Trump didn't invent this. Trump is just the worst symptom of something that's been going on for a very long time. And the whole thrust of it is basically a move in the direction of an authoritarian regime. And it should be seen in the same terms as what we see happening around the world, from the Philippines to Turkey to the Soviet Union, you know, all these other places that we justifiably could point our fingers at in horror. We're going through something very similar ourselves.
Well, I'll just say, finally, you do point to pushback that's ongoing. It's not that this is happening under complete darkness. The people, when they've had it put before them, have indicated that they're interested in moving to structurally stop this sort of thing.
Right. There was very successful initiatives to implement nonpartisan redistricting commissions. And even in Michigan, where Republican office holders attacked it as a power grab, it was just overwhelmingly approved. And in North Carolina, where the Republicans tried to cripple the Election Oversight Board, that was rejected overwhelmingly there, too. So the public sentiment is very strongly against this. And, you know, I think that developments like the formation of indivisible groups and other similar kinds of groups that have popped up around the country have been very important in changing the climate. And they're going to be even more important going forward, because it's decentralized resistance like this. It's not atomized, it's networked, but that's also not imposed from the top, because, you know, even the best intentioned leaders, political leaders at the top of parties, are compromised by the nature of those parties. And it takes consistent grassroots pressure from below to really achieve the kind of change that's needed. Hopefully we've seen a lot more of that this time around, and we're just going to need an awful lot more of that going forward to continue countering this, because they're not going to stop what they're doing. They're fighting in ways that people have never expected before, and we should expect them to keep developing new ways of trying to subvert public will.
We've been speaking with Paul Rosenberg. His piece, The GOP's Anti-Democratic Red Tide, It's Ugly, But It's Nothing New, can still be found at Salon.com. Paul Rosenberg, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Well, thank you for having me.
U.S. news media make a lot of rhetorical reference to family and to jobs. Yet a story, a reality, that occurs at their intersection is somehow in a kind of blind spot. That would be domestic workers, the more than 2 million people, mostly women of color, who care for Americans' children, elders, family members with disabilities, and homes. Domestic workers are a keystone in U.S. society and the economy. Their work makes other work possible. So what has allowed them to work without the rights or basic protections that other workers expect? And what is the plan to change that? We're joined now by Mariana Vitoro. She's deputy director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. She joins us now by phone from a New York City taxi cab. Welcome to Counterspin, Mariana Vitoro.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, I think that there is a lot of missing information here about the situation that domestic workers are in. So maybe before we talk about this National Domestic Workers Bill of Rights, which is such an exciting development, but let's first talk about why it's necessary.
Yeah, and just to say, we estimate there's over 2 million domestic workers around the country, and domestic workers are nannies who care for our children, house cleaners who care for our homes, and home care workers who care for our elders and people with disabilities. They are 90% women, disproportionately women of color. And they've historically been really invisible and excluded from most of the kind of labor rights and protections that we've come to know. They work in private homes behind closed doors. And although they're fundamental, as you said, to everyone else's work, they're largely undervalued, unrecognized, and vulnerable to exploitation and abuse. And in some ways, we're still sort of fighting against exclusions of this workforce from laws that were enacted during the New Deal in the 1930s. And it's largely because it's work that has been historically done by women, but also work that was at the time done by African American women in the South. And it was the legacy of slavery that led to them not being recognized as workers and not given the same rights and protections as others. And so for the last 20 years, we've been working to make these jobs good jobs. And that's where the kind of impetus for this federal Bill of Rights is really about kind of fixing the continuing like sort of exclusion of domestic workers and really trying to bring domestic workers into the 21st century where they can have access to the safety net, to equal protections against sexual harassment, have access to benefits and paid time off.
Very basic things. And I would just underscore that when you say that domestic workers were excluded from certain workplace guarantees, they were specifically excluded. It's not like they were overlooked. When legislation was passed, they were kind of circled and said, but not them, you know. So it's a very directed exclusion that we're looking to rectify right now.
That's exactly right. And it was the exclusion of domestic workers and farm workers at the time that was really about mostly Southern legislators not wanting to extend those rights and protections to workers or even give them the ability to organize and form unions and have a voice on the job.
Right. And then the Civil Rights Act overlooks them in a different way because it excludes workplaces with fewer than 15 employees. And so if you're talking about home workers, then they fall through that crack as well, right?
Yeah. Exactly. So some of the exclusions are specific, are like specifically defined as domestic worker exclusions. Some are because of the nature of the industry being where it's a one employer to one worker relationship
right.
in the workplace, that they don't meet the sort of threshold in some of the laws and protections that we know.
And of course, it's behind those closed doors that some of the abuses that we hear about, you know, anecdotally occur. And I don't think it's too difficult for people to imagine, but if we're just talking about the kinds of people who we're looking to uplift with this law, it's people who maybe they're going to care for an older person, and that older person is racist, and that's just part of what they have to deal with every day, and up till now, they haven't had any really recourse to do anything about it.
Yeah, it's both the fact that the workplace is in a private home, and also the fact that the workforce is overwhelmingly women, and women of color and immigrant women. There's just a higher vulnerability to abuse and harassment and discrimination. And workers don't have the protections against discrimination and harassment that other workers do, nor do they have, as you said, the recourse to be able to exercise their rights when they do face violations.
What do we think this federal Domestic Workers Bill of Rights will do? As part of answering that, it's been kind of tried out. We've seen laws at the local and that state level, and they've had an impact, right? So let's just finish up by talking about what these laws have changed and what you hope the federal law will change.
Yeah, so today we have 8 states and the city of Seattle that have enacted Domestic Worker Bill of Rights. And in those states, you know, workers feel more empowered and feel like they can negotiate and enter into a different kind of work agreement,
right,
knowing that they have those basic protections and rights. And we've also seen that employers have also changed their value and dignity that they provide domestic workers through these bills. Because in some ways, we've not only sort of visibilized the workforce, but we've also won recognition that these are workers and deserve the same, you know, rights and compensation and fair standards that other workers do. And that in itself has had an impact. Not to mention that workers now have a recourse to be able to win sort of back wages or compensation if their rights have been violated.
This is going to be in the new Congress. It's been unveiled, but we have to still watch its fortunes. And I assume that media attention on it would be helpful in terms of the success of this National Domestic Workers Bill of Rights.
Absolutely. And we are thrilled to have Senator Harris and Representative Jayapal join us in introducing this bill in the 2019 Congress. And really, it's really about starting this conversation and educating legislators and the public about the importance of this workforce and how it's been left out of what we know our rights and benefits afforded to other workers.
All right, then. Well, we will keep our eyes on this as we go forward. We've been speaking with Mariana Vituro. She's the deputy director at the National Domestic Workers Alliance. Mariana Vituro, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Parents and young people, WNUC 96.7 FM is looking for young Detroiters from age 7 to 17 desiring to learn studio skills, media literacy, and teamwork.
Learn how to become a careful listener, a skilled audio mixer, and a confident young broadcaster. If you run a youth group and want to include radio training, this message is also for you.
Email me, Reverend Joan Ross, at revjoan@wnuc.org. That's Rev Joan at wnuc.org. And learn more about our Radio to the Future afternoon summer program. Join WNUC Detroit's only community radio station here for Detroiters of all ages. Thank you.